The reading today is from Judges chapter 4. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Haggoyim. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he had 900 chariots of iron, and he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel, in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kedesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go, gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun. And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, I will go, but if you will not go with me, I will not go." And she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kedesh. And Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh. And 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak at Zaananim, which is near Kedesh. When Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him, from Harosheth Haggoyim to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor, with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth Haggoyim, and all the people of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not be afraid." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead, with the tent peg in his temple. So on that day God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel, and the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan.
In our family, everybody knows this truth. Never watch a murder mystery with my mum. There's a reason for this. You see, my mum has watched so many murder mysteries that within 5 minutes of the programme starting, she points at someone and she goes, "I think he did it." Now, 2 hours into this mystery, you find out that the person who murdered someone is revealed. And they have this big reveal, and they point out that the person is the same person our mum points out in the first 5 minutes. Now, there's a reason she knows these things. It's not magic. You see, murder mysteries are predictable. They always leave clues, something that shows you who the murderer is early on. They can't help but do it. And my mum, she notices the clues, and therefore she predicts the murderer. Now, in the same way, we can guess the predictable pattern of our passage. We know that Israel will sin, and we know that the enemy will prevail over them as God gives the Israel into their hands. We know that Israel will cry out for a saviour, and God will send a saviour. Murder mysteries also follow a similar plot. If you've watched them before, they always begin with a murder. Then there's this investigation into who did it. And then there's this big reveal at the end when everybody is brought into the same room. And one by one, Hercule Poirot will go around the room explaining exactly what happened, who did what. And the murderer always confesses that they are guilty. And it ends. However, unlike a murder mystery, God's methods are unpredictable. You see, he saves in ways that we might never expect. Although we can be certain that he will save those who cry for help, his methods, the way he does it, is unpredictable. And we won't automatically know how he's going to do it. So I've got 3 points. Number one, the expected pattern. Look at Judges chapter 4, verse 1. Now, things haven't changed much. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. You see, the previous judge, Ehud, he's died, and the same old cycle of disobedience has begun all over again. Israel disobeyed God. They do evil. God gives them into the hand of their enemies. Their enemies treat them horribly. And so they cry out to God. In fact, the writer appears to be getting a little bit cheesed off with the whole thing at this point. Because in verse 1 he says, again they've done evil. Again, it's repeating itself, it's going round in circles. And therefore God sells them into the hand of their enemies, in verse 2. If they want to live like the Canaanites, then they're going to be sold to the Canaanites. If they want to worship the gods of the Canaanites, let's see how well those gods protect you when your enemies come. Now, this is slightly different than before. With Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar, the enemies had been invaders from the outside. From Mesopotamia, from the Moabites, the Philistines, they're all outside invaders. But this time, the enemy has come from within. The enemy is Canaan. Now, Canaan were the people who possessed the land, the promised land, before Israel. They shouldn't exist. You might remember that Israel was told to go into the land of Canaan and to wipe out the Canaanites, to get rid of them from the land. But instead, they enslave them. They know better than God. They enslave the Canaanites, and the Canaanites live. And over the years, they grow in power, and now they've become strong enough that they suddenly rise up. Under King Jabin, they rise up and they start to oppress Israel. In verse 3, we read how Jabin's main commander, the commander of his army, is Sisera. And Sisera seems to be the strength behind this whole people group. Jabin is the king, but Sisera is the army commander, and he seems to be the one who they look to protect their cause. So Sisera had 900 chariots of iron. That means they are a mighty war machine, something that Israel will struggle to fight. And he oppresses the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Now, it suddenly dawns on Israel that they've given up God for this. They've given up God to be treated cruelly by this evil ruler. And so they do what they suddenly realize they ought to do. They cry out to God. They say, God, save us from this oppressor. Now, at this point, I want to just pause. You might be becoming accustomed to this pattern. We've looked for a few judges, and you might get used to this. But I don't want you to become desensitized to the tragedy of Israel's behavior. You see, not only Israel, but all of mankind follow a similar pattern, consistently. As surely as God shows mercy, and mercy to a people, just as surely they will turn their back on him again. Again and again throughout history, God has shown mercy, God has saved, God has shown grace, but people again and again turn to their own ways. And they follow evil and wicked ways. Think of the mercy of God, that he should bring salvation to people like this. That he should bring salvation to a person and peoples who turn again and again to wickedness, who turn their back on him again and again. And think of your own role in this. Do we not need to repent of our own part in this wickedness, in our daily sin and rebellion against God? Again and again God shows mercy to us. Again and again we turn back to our own evil ways. But we must also remember that whenever the people cry out to God, he always listens. He saves. He doesn't say enough now. You've sinned too many times, that's the end. He hears them and he saves them. And though the people again have done evil in his sight, again God will show mercy. Again he is gracious. See what an amazing and merciful God he is. Number two, God's unpredictable methods. You see, God, although we know he will save those who cry to him, he doesn't always do it the same way. Let's look in our passage. First of all, we're introduced to Deborah. Now, as a female judge, she's unusual. There's a female judge, Deborah. We're told she's a prophetess. In other words, she speaks the words of God. And she does this multiple times in our passage, in verse 6 and 7, and in verse 14, she speaks the words of God. We're told she's married to Lapidoth in verse 4. We don't hear anything more about Lapidoth, he's not mentioned again. Deborah is the ruler, the leader, she's the important one here. She appears to be perhaps the most upright of the judges. We're told she holds court. She basically judges between different Israelites about what is right and what is wrong. And in chapter 5 verse 7 we're told she is a mother in Israel. So she's become the leader in Israel with the absence of anyone else to rule. She's become the ruler, the leader. She's leading people in the ways that God wants them to live. And you might think, here's the person to save Israel. We know God's going to save them, and she seems like the best candidate at this moment. Well, no, she's not. Instead, she summons a man named Barak, and she passes on God's commission to him. She says to him in verse 6, "Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go gather your men at Mount Tabor." So Barak has been selected to go and gather the armies. And he's to lead them on the battlefield. But, just like Deborah, he's not going to get the honour. He's not going to get the glory. You see, the glory and the honour will go to someone else. We'll look at that in a moment. Now, it's worth pointing out that Barak is also mentioned in Hebrews 11. In verse 32, he is presented as an example of faith. The list in Hebrews 11 is of men and women of faith, and Barak is listed there. It says this, verse 32, "For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith," and then it goes on to say all the things that they did through faith. So Barak there is an example of faith. Now, how Barak displays this faith is a matter of discussion and debate. You see, there's basically two views of how he showed faith. One is a pessimistic view, and the other is a more optimistic view of him. I'm going to tell you both of them, and see which one you think is more persuasive. I've shifted my position on this. So, the pessimistic view is this. that when Deborah asks him to go to war, Barak in verse 8, when he says, let me read it to you, "If you will go with me, I will go, but if you will not go with me, I will not go." The pessimistic view says that's a refusal to go unless she goes with him because he lacks faith. Because he doesn't believe God, the pessimistic view says that he lacks faith, so he's not going to go unless she goes with him. And particularly if you're reading the NIV translation, this makes sense. When it says in verse 9, "But because of the way you are going about this," in other words, because you're refusing to go with me, "the honour will not be yours, for the Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman." If you're reading the NIV and you take this translation, then Deborah's rebuking Barak. She's saying, because you've done something wrong, the honour's not going to be yours. And so the idea here is that only in verse 13 and 14, when again she says, "Up, for this day on which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand, does not the Lord go out before you?" does Barak show his faith and go. And that's the faith he's commended for in Hebrews 11. That's the pessimistic view. Now, the optimistic view is different. It translates verse 9 different. This is a valid translation. There's two different translations you can take from verse 9. You see, it can also be translated, and you'll see that as a footnote in the NIV, as, "On the expedition you are undertaking, the honour will not be yours." On the expedition you are undertaking, the honour will not be yours. In this take of events, Deborah is explaining that though Barak will lead a charge against a powerful and ruthless enemy, he will not get the glory for it. This is a prophetic statement rather than a rebuke. To add to that argument, we've got in verse 9, she says, "I will surely go with you." It's not a problem for her to go with him, but she's got to tell him this truth, that the glory won't be his, that he'll have to go, he'll have to fight his enemy, but the person who will save the people will not be him. And so in this reading of events, Barak demanding that Deborah go with him is an act of faith, because he will not go without God's prophetess. In other words, Barak's acknowledging that he is not strong enough on his own, that he needs God's helper, this woman Deborah, to go with him. And so it's an act of faith to want Deborah to go with him. Now, to be honest, before I started studying the passage, I had the pessimistic view. I thought he was saying he didn't want to go, and that was because he didn't have any faith. But I've actually shifted. I'm now more convinced by the optimistic view. If you want to chat with me about that, I'd be happy to chat. There's a little bit more evidence, but I think that's the most persuasive that I've told you there. Anyway, either way, when the battle is fought, it's God that gives the Israelites a great victory. God is on their side. It's God who's given the Canaanites into their hand, and they utterly defeat the Canaanites. Now, we're going to look at the battle in more detail when I preach through chapter 5. We're going to dig into what happened in that battle and why. But notice here that victory on the battlefield is certain because the Lord is fighting for Israel. It's the Lord who's fighting for Israel. Now, there's a problem. In the battle that they win, they don't kill Sisera. And there's probably a suggestion here that if Sisera escapes, he is the strength of the army. He is the one who's going to go regather the troops, he's going to return, and he's going to defeat Israel. So without Sisera dead, there can be no true victory. It's just a hollow victory. Now, Sisera, he's fled the battlefield, and he's taken refuge in the tent of Heber the Kenite. Now, this is where the story gets really strange. You see, in verse 11, we were told, seemingly randomly, I don't know if you noticed that, about Heber the Kenite. It's just this random verse that tells us about this man, and then it moves on. You see, Heber the Kenite, he's moved away from the Kenites, and he happens to have pitched his tents near the location of the battlefield. Now, if you don't know about the Kenites, they were friendly to Israel, they weren't Israelites. They descended from Jethro, whose other name is Hobab, that is used in this passage, and they have lived among the Israelites, but they're not Israelites. They are friendly. We're told in verse 17 there's been peace between Heber the Kenite and Jabin, the king of the Canaanites. their allies. And seemingly Sisera has found a hiding place nearby the battlefield with one of the king's allies. You know, what you might think, what good luck for him. And he's going to escape to fight another day. No, instead he's found a hidden enemy. Now, let's not beat around the bush here. What happens next seems extremely morally questionable. Jael, now she's not an Israelite, she doesn't follow the Ten Commandments necessarily, but nevertheless her actions are brutal. They are brutal. We never get her reasoning why she does it, but she absolutely breaks the rules of hospitality that tends to exist around the world. She gives Sisera something to drink, she says she'll hide him, she puts him to bed, and then she sneaks in and gets one of the tent pegs and hammers it into his head while he's sleeping. Completely brutal, pretty horrific, and morally, you know, that's all over the place. Now, in one sense, this should point us towards the moral standards that are beginning to be eroded in and around Israel at this time. And you will see as we go through Judges that things will get worse. They're not going to get better. The standards are going to get worse and worse, and morals are going to drop away. And it's going to become more savage, more violent, more sinful. Nevertheless, in another sense, Jael, she wins the glory that's mentioned in verse 9. Because she kills the enemy of God's people. She's the one who kills Sisera. More than this, we're told in verse 23, "So on that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan." God uses this brutal murder to save his people. And here, I guess we ask the question, how can such a thing be? We would never predict that God would work in this way. How can such a thing be? So number 3, the unpredictable certainty of God. Well, this brings us to a truth I want us to remember. With God's plans, there is unpredictable certainty. We can be absolutely confident that the outcome of God's plan, about the outcome of God's plans. We can know that when God has a plan, it comes true. We can know when he has a desire, something he's going to make done, he will do it. But we don't know how he will fulfill it. You see, when the people cry out to God in verse 3, we know that God will save them. Don't we? Because we know God always saves the people who cry to him. But we don't know how he will do it. God always fulfills what he says and completes his promises. And we see this pattern again and again. As Joel 2 puts it, "Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." We should not delude ourselves into thinking that we know how he will do it, or that we can understand all his methods. Who would have predicted that Jael, not an Israelite, not in a way we expect, would kill the enemy of God, and that God would use that to save his people? His methods are unpredictable. They often make no sense. Sometimes God even uses for good things that are outright evil. For example, in the story of Joseph. Joseph is sold by his brothers into slavery. It doesn't take an expert to see that that's an awful evil act by his brothers. There's nothing good about that. They don't do it for any good reason. It's completely horrific. It's completely evil. It's completely awful. But God uses this to save many people. You see, Joseph realizes this later in life. Later in the story of Joseph, he talks to his brothers in Genesis 50, and he says to them, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. You meant evil against me, and you really did mean evil, but God meant it for good." So God used something that was horrific for good. Another example. Look at the cross of Christ. An awful, evil murder of a man who had done nothing wrong. a murder to abate the crowd's anger. A murder because religious leaders wanted him dead. It's completely horrific, and yet that death on the cross by Jesus was used for the salvation of God's people. You would never predict it, and yet it's the way God worked. God is often working in ways that make no sense to us. I came across this example when I was preparing this sermon. This is a recollection told by Charles Spurgeon. If you don't know who he is, he was a preacher about 150 years ago-ish, not sure exactly, in England, and he was known as the Prince of Preachers. He was this amazing preacher. But when he was 15 years old, he was trudging up Hive Hill in Colchester, not a famous city, Colchester particularly, but that happened to be where he was. He was going up a hill on his way to church, and this is what he tells us. He said, "I sometimes think I might have been in darkness and despair now, had it not been for the goodness of God in sending a snowstorm one Sunday morning. When I was going to a place of worship, I could go no further. It was too snowy. I turned down a court and came to a little primitive Methodist chapel. In that chapel, there might have been a dozen or 15 people. The minister did not come that morning. He was snowed up, I suppose. A poor man, a shoemaker, a tailor, or something of that sort, went into the pulpit to preach. He was obliged to stick to his text, for the simple reason that he had nothing else to say. The text was, 'Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth,' from Isaiah 45:22. He did not even pronounce the words right, but that did not matter. There was, I thought, a glimpse of hope for me in the text. He began thus, 'My dear friends, this is a very simple text indeed. It says, look. Now that does not take a deal of effort. It ain't lifting your foot or your finger. It is just, look. Well, a man need not go to college to learn to look. You may be the biggest fool, and yet you can look. A man need not be worth $1,000 a year just to look. Anyone can look. A child can look. But this is what the text says. Then it says, look unto me. Aye, he said he in broad Essex, many of ye are looking to yourselves. No use looking there. You'll never find comfort in yourselves. Then the good man followed up his text in this way. Look unto me. I am sweating great drops of blood. Look unto me, I am hanging on the cross. Look, I am dead and buried. Look unto me, I rise again. Look unto me, I ascend. I am sitting at the Father's right hand. Oh, look to me, look to me. When he had got about that length and managed to spin out 10 minutes, he was at the length of his tether. Then he looked at me under the gallery. And I dare say, with so few present, he knew me to be a stranger. He then said, young man, you look very miserable. Well, I did. But I'd not been accustomed to have remarks made on my personal appearance from the pulpit before. However, it was a good blow struck. He continued, and you will always be miserable, miserable in life, and miserable in death, if you do not obey my text. But if you obey now, this moment you will be saved. Then he shouted, as only a primitive Methodist can, young man, look to Jesus Christ. There and then the cloud was gone, the darkness had rolled away, and that moment I saw the sun, and I could have risen that moment and sung with the most enthusiastic of them, of the precious blood of Christ. I know it's a long story, but it's a good story, so I wanted to read it to you all. Now, in one sense, this story is all wrong, at least according to our wisdom. We've got a snowstorm that stops a young man going to his usual place of worship. He goes to this tiny church with barely 15 people, 12, 15 people in there. A preacher is there without any training. He preaches a message that's only 10 minutes long. You won't predict that this was the place of salvation or the place of glory. The fact that he pointed at Charles and spoke directly to him, a lot of people would shake their heads at that and say, well, that's not right. But it was here that Charles Spurgeon put his faith in Christ. This very situation, unpredictable, was used by God to save a man who would go on to preach and be part of the salvation of countless others. Even if you consider your own salvation, when you were saved, I dare say when you consider it, you can think of things that happened to you that are unusual, that people would think, that's odd, that was the thing that caused you to be saved. I'm sure, as we share stories of how we're saved, we will find unpredictable methods that happened. God's salvation is certain for those who cry to him, but his methods are so often unpredictable. Now, finally, let me end with this. Suffice to say that people don't like this. You see, they want things clear-cut and obvious. They want black and white. They want tick boxes, ways in which we, as a church, can save people. They're never happy unless they understand every inch of God's plans. But to live by faith, that means to trust God, though you don't understand. You see, to live by faith is to trust God's certainties alongside his unpredictable methods. In a world drenched with sin, evil and death, we can be confident that God is always working his purposes without any difficulty. You see, God's not thwarted by sin. He works despite it. He works through it for the good of those he loves. And he saves those he loves. He saves his people. So remember this. When hardship hits you, when you don't understand things, when you're in the middle of a pandemic, shut away in your home, not meeting anyone, and think, what is God doing? Have faith and remember the unpredictable certainties of God.